Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this next podcast installment recorded on February 22nd, 2009. The title of this podcast is Subscriber Questions, and with me today, as always, is Becca Martinson.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Today we will be entirely dedicated to answering subscriber questions since we've had so many good ones come in. I want to note that several subscribers have stated a strong preference for written reports, and I want to just assure everybody that those are going to keep coming. But I've had a lot of feedback from other subscribers as well that they really do prefer the podcast. So I'm going to try and balance all of these needs out, get something for everyone if we can. Some people do learn best by hearing, and some do better by reading, and we're going to do everything we can to keep both formats moving. So that's what we're up to today. And Becca, do we have a question we can move to?
Absolutely. So here's the first question from Tristan in Halifax, Vermont. He asks, Chris, can you discuss in more detail your thoughts on trading currencies, specifically through vehicles offered by Everbank, such as CDs? In a previous podcast, you were negative about trading currencies, but in your Swiss franc alert, you revealed that you do engage in this area.
Great question, Tristan. And I want to be very clear about the difference between trading and investing. I had been holding Swiss francs for probably about a three-year period of time, and I was doing that on the basis of investing in a fundamental trend that I had observed. Trading currencies is not something I do, meaning moving in and out of currencies in accordance with some assessment as to whether they're going to go up or down. Frankly, I don't do that because I am not a good enough trader to do that. That is one of the most difficult, tricky areas to really engage in, and I completely admire and respect people who can trade currencies. So for me, the Swiss francs were part of a limited part of my core holdings. By limited, I mean I never had any more than 7% of my total holdings in foreign currencies at any one time. But I did hold some as a hedge against a loss of power, purchasing power, or erosion in the value of the U.S. dollar. And I did that again on the basis of investing on a long-term trend in noting that the dollar was in a sustained downtrend. So that's the difference between trading and investing for me. The reason I don't trade currencies, and though I do trade other things out there, there are certain vehicles that I will use. I'm very comfortable trading stocks. I'm very comfortable trading futures. But currencies, not so much. And here's why. First of all, I was shocked by the dollar strength. That caught me off guard. And really, as I've come to discover, that was a measure of how shocked I was by the foolishness of European banks. I did not expect that. The dollar has been gaining in large measure because European banks have been extremely, extremely foolish in their lending practices to Eastern European countries and other things that they've done. So the measure of the dollar in this case, I think, is really we're talking about measuring how things are going, relatively speaking, in other parts of the world. So that's part one. I am still in Canadian loonies at this point in time, and the reason for that is fundamentally, relatively, I can look at Canada and say, gosh, here's a country with both a trade surplus and a government budget surplus. And when I put both of those two things together, I'm looking at a position where I think that on a relative basis, there's a chance for the Canadian loonie to perform a little bit better. And for me, the Canadian loonie actually has some utility because I go up to Canada quite a bit on business and to meet with friends up there. So that's also part of my personal equation around that.
You know, Chris, we had a variety of questions about currencies that came in, and a number of people were worried about the potential for a dollar collapse. Here are two different questions perhaps you could answer all at once. Joe from Milford asks, I keep hearing currency devaluation, including the U.S. dollar, but I still can't seem to grasp the concept. I know Russia has been devaluing their currency, and I know other countries have done it in the past. Argentina comes to mind. And here's a question from Tom in Maine. A question I have, when you feel the timing is appropriate, is on the possibility of devaluation of the dollar down the road. Why and how is it done? What are the impacts? And what should one do to protect against this?
Well, here I think we need to, let me just spend a minute talking about why currencies move relative to one to another. Since August 15th, 1971, we've been on a floating exchange rate currency system. And of course, this is now a 39-year-old experiment in 38-year experiment in allowing currencies to float against each other. So the question then becomes, why do currencies move up or down? And there are two sets of reasons for that. The first is fundamental in nature. Trade balances. These have an enormous impact on currencies moving up or down. So a country that is running a persistent and sustained negative trade balance, meaning they're importing more than they're exporting, they're bringing goods in. Well, what's leaving your shores when the goods come in? Well, that's your currency. So for any other country besides the United States, which enjoys the exorbitant privilege, to quote Mitterrand, that was Charles de Gaulle, the exorbitant privilege of having a reserve currency means that you can continue to export those dollars in seemingly unlimited quantities and be importing goods without really impacting the value of your currency. But for any other country, this does not hold. So if you're Argentina, or if you happen to be New Zealand, or if you're Zimbabwe, for instance, when you are running a persistent, sustained trade deficit, what it means is that your currency will start to weaken persistently and until such point in time as when you can't import anymore. Or your currency becomes so weak that people from outside start coming into your country to buy your goods, your services, other things, because it's such a bargain. So that's the fundamental reason. There's other minor reasons around that, which could be the interest rate differential. So if Canada's offering 20% return on their federal money offered, and the United States is offering 0%, money will start to move over into Canada for obvious reasons. So that's an extreme example. Obviously, interest rate differentials are measured in tiny fractions of a percent. I just use 20% to illustrate. So those are the fundamental reasons. But if I could just trade on fundamental reasons, I think I could do a great job. The problem is that almost all currencies, their value is really an act of policy. So the Bank of International Settlements, which is the banker's bank, it's located in Basel, Switzerland, and it's really the where all the central banks kind of get their central guidance from, if you will. The BIS has all these position papers and researchers, and they're constantly putting out addendums and acts and policies and things that all the banks have to follow. The BIS, love them. They've got a very open website, and on that website, they have a number of papers that talk about the best ways for governments and central banks to manipulate currencies. They talk about the importance of hiding your tracks, of using proxies, of using other banks that can come in and do the bidding of the central banks, even though it's not entirely clear where the money's coming from. So in many cases, currencies and their values are now also subject to acts of policy. And one of the biggest acts of policies that we saw in the Great Depression was something called competitive currency devaluation. Once the world was caught up in the global downturn in economic activity in 1930 and 31, various countries immediately hit upon the strategy, the tactic, of lowering the value of their currency relative to other currencies because of the same reason I just described earlier. When your currency goes down, people from outside your country will come and start to buy your goods and your services, and it can stimulate your economy. So, a simple example, if Mercedes is suffering under a very, very strong German currency, and so a Mercedes costs the equivalent of $100,000, I think a lot fewer of them are going to be sold than if Germany devalues its currency to half its current value, and comparatively to a United States citizen, now a Mercedes is $50,000, you can see how that would spur the trade or the purchase of Mercedes by U.S. citizens. So I want to define a dollar collapse. Very important thing to do. I'm going to define this as a large and sustained move down compared to other currencies. Now, here's where I'm running into a little bit of analytical trouble, because I can't, when I compare the United States dollar's prospects and I look at those compared against what's going on in Euro land over there, what's going on with the Swiss franc, in Japan, with the ruble, with the Chinese yuan, all of these currencies now are starting to be manipulated in order to help get those countries through whatever crises they're in right now. And this is a really big analytical nightmare, because I don't know how much they're printing. I just know that they're printing. Each one of those countries I just mentioned is now engaged in a policy of quantitative easing, with the exception of China. I haven't heard about that yet, but I think they're getting there. And this quantitative easing means that the central banks of those countries are printing money out of thin air in order to buy up unproductive or unsaleable debt assets or instruments off the open market. So there's all this money being flooding out there. So this is a very tricky thing to analyze in terms of making a guess as to where is one currency going to be relative to another. And that's why I backed away from the Swiss francs. I saw some fundamental reasons why the Swiss franc could possibly fall. But now that so many countries and governments are actively involved in attempting to manage their economies by manipulating their currencies through the act of printing, I can no longer trust my fundamental analysis as giving me any good clues as to where this is going to go. So that's the first part. Second part is, if the dollar does fall, then what happens and how do you protect against that? Very simply, if the dollar fell relative to other currencies, then we would see import prices shoot up. Imports would possibly get pinched off as other countries were no longer willing to accept a devaluing U.S. currency in exchange for their goods. So we might even see some goods disappear from our shelves. That's certainly a possibility. The way you protect against an inflationary event due to a currency collapse, obviously, is that you want to hold other currencies or gold or various other commodities or anything that can be priced outside of the currency zone that you're living in. So this would apply equally if you're in the U.S. living with dollars or in Euroland living with euros. That's what you could do. Now, the problem is right now at this point is, what happens if you're worried that all the fiat currencies are being mismanaged? Then what do you do? Well, the first thing I do is, from that prior list, I would strike currencies off of that list as something that you could invest in or as a means of protecting yourself. So if the United States is printing and all the other countries are printing, it doesn't really matter which currency you're holding. So my immediate answer around that is, I have moved very aggressively in my own holdings away from fiat currencies at this point. I have a pretty large amount of distrust built up right now about how those crises are being managed, because it appears to me that the same exact mechanism we always see, which is governments backed into an economic crisis, choose to print their way out of that crisis. It provides temporary relief, but it always ends the same way, which is a large portion of the people calling into question the value of the currencies involved.
Chris, you mentioned gold a couple of times, and that flows perfectly into our next question from Rob in British Columbia. He asks, "You've done an excellent job of explaining why it is important to hold some gold. I feel that I have a good understanding of gold's upsides, but I lack an equal understanding of gold's downsides. Would you please discuss the downside risks of gold? Note that I'm not talking about conspiracy theories like the threat of government confiscation, nor am I talking about normal price fluctuations. I'm talking about market forces that could cause the price of gold to fall and not recover for a long time."
Very interesting. And this raises the central point around any investment. And by the way, gold is just one investment vehicle that's on my radar screen. Every investment, you should have a desired entrance point, and you got to have an exit point. And so the question here really is got two parts for me. The first is, what's the exit strategy? And the second part is around, what are the market forces that could cause gold to fall in a very long, persistent fashion? So first of all, let's discuss the history of gold. In 6,000 years, I can't find a single example where gold has ever gone to zero. It's not in the record books. So it's one of the few investments that you can look at where you can be pretty confident it's never going to go to zero. It could fall a lot, but one thing it's not going to do is fall all the way to zero. And my personal view on things that could cause gold to fall at this point in time, some of the warning signs that I'm going to be looking for that says, oops, it's time to get out of this particular investment vehicle at this point in time. The first thing is, if my government begins to run persistent and sustained budget surpluses. So I think we're pretty safe this year, probably pretty safe next year on this one. But there are other things that could actually come into play. A second would be that interest rates rise to a level that becomes compelling. So if I'm sitting here holding gold and it's paying no interest and it's just, you know, either accumulating gains or losses depending on how the market is interpreting the value of gold at that point in time, I will start to move away from that in preference for higher yielding assets once they become compelling. So let's cast back to what Paul Volcker did when he was confronted with a currency crisis back in the 70s. He raised short-term interest rates up to an all-time high of 21% in the early 1980s. So at that point in time, people who were holding gold or, you know, had the opportunity to buy a 30-year bond at 15% started to make that choice. Gold fell pretty sharply in price after that, and people were moving in preference out of gold back into bonds. I mean, imagine something where you're guaranteed a 15% compounded return for 30 years. It's pretty awesome. That is an incredible investment. And so compounded, if you could take that 15% interest and put it back into those bonds, obviously. So that would be another thing. Interest rates would rise to a level that becomes compelling. Right now, interest rates are at zero. For 10 years, you're being paid somewhere in the vicinity of less than 3% for the benefit of loaning your money to the government for 10 years. These are not compelling numbers to me at this point in time. And I also am not too worried that anytime in the near future, we're going to see short-term interest rates be willingly raised by the Federal Reserve in a Volcker-style fashion. They might be forced to if they have to defend the currency at some point, but I don't think they would willingly do that because that would really just put a couple more arrows into the economy that it just doesn't need at this point in time. A third thing would be that the U.S. starts running persistent trade surpluses. And the reason I'm focusing on the U.S. here is because gold is still priced in dollars pretty much worldwide. It's one of the other advantages to having the world's reserve currency. Many, many commodities happen to be priced in that currency. So gold is still priced in dollars. One of the things that could cause the dollar to rise and accordingly gold to fall would be for the U.S. to run persistent trade surpluses. Now, we're very, very far away from that moment in time. We probably still have, we'll have in the vicinity of a $600 to a $700 billion trade deficit this year, and that's going to unwind very slowly through time. It'll probably be 5-10 years before the U.S., through normal mechanisms, could work its way back to a trade, positive trade balance. And the last thing that I would be on the lookout for is if the world governments that I just talked about, who are all engaging in this quantitative easing, which is printing, if they stopped doing that and they started moving towards more sane, more rational, less monetary expansive policies, I would also consider that a sign that I would want to begin thinking about moving out of gold. So there are a couple things I would move out of gold into. This brings us to the exit strategy portion. One of my long-term key metrics has always been that when I can convert an ounce of gold into an acre of productive land, I will begin to make that trade all day long until my gold is gone. And I will do that on the basis of the fact that when I look back through history, that's a rough ratio that's held for good long periods of time. And I wouldn't be surprised to see us get back to that same rough approximation. And so if it gets to, you know, 2 ounces per acre or, you know, three or maybe goes to half, it's going to be somewhere in that zone, though. And so my rule of thumb as I squint through the mist has been, you know, when we get to an acre for an ounce, I'm going to start doing that. And then the second, obviously, is if I start to see compelling interest rates come back into the landscape that would cause me to want to move back into paper assets. But right now, very comfortable just holding and sitting and waiting.
All right, shifting gears a bit, we've got a tough question from Steve in Ohio. Steve asks, I have 2 small children, ages 5 and 7, that I'm fully responsible for. Their mother lives far away. With things being as precarious as they are, would you advise against any type of travel within this country that would separate me from them? Are we to the point now where I pretty much need to be in the same city with them all the time to ensure their safety? I wouldn't want to have a banking collapse and shutdown of credit cards while they're at their grandma's house in Florida, 1,000 miles from me.
Oh, Steve, that is a hard question, and I fully sympathize with that. You know, this past October, when we were having our market correction, I had somebody write me an email, and it was a fairly, there was a little edge to this email, and this person was really concerned because they lived pretty far out in the Southwest, and they happened to be in Boston at that moment in time, and they were wondering, should they just up and get themselves home right away? They were feeling the urgency of the situation, and certainly I share that sense of urgency, but my response back to this person was, first, I've been watching things for a long time, and my conclusion is that this unwinding is going to be relatively slow, fairly persistent affair. There will be sharp shocks and jolts along the way, but I don't think it's going to go down to you know, the basement level all at once. And there's we really have to appreciate there's an enormous amount of inertia and resiliency built into the system. And while it is eroding and crumbling at the moment, it's not going to do it all at once. But to put your mind at ease, what I would do is I would think about a variety of ways that I could reconnect with my children under a variety of scenarios and circumstances I could think of. So to this gentleman who emailed in, was all worried at the time, I said, my advice to him was, well, I'd found out that he had a rental car and he was going to fly back. And I said, well, I would get myself a map that could cover all the roads between here and where I wanted to get to. And I would go to Home Depot and I'd buy myself some gas cans that would take me for the whole trip, save the receipt. And then that's that. Maybe have some cash on hand and continue to do your business. And if things broke, well, then run down and fill those cans up. And if things didn't break, which they didn't, you can always just run back and take those cans back and get a receipt for them and, you know, turn them back in and move on. And the important point here is that you should do what you need to do in order to relieve the anxiety. Even if those steps turn out to be unnecessary, or even if you feel like those steps were somehow insufficient for all possible circumstances, take whatever steps you need to in order to feel comfortable in the moment with that. And I think you're thinking about the right things. The piece I really want to communicate the most, though, is that it just seems almost entirely unthinkable and improbable to me that things will unwind so fast that they cut off all your options. You will have plenty of time, plenty of options, but please be sure that you're maintaining vigilance to the unfolding events that are going on out there and keep your eye on the ball, because certainly things could change relatively quickly. And that's what I do, and that's what many people at the site are doing anyway. We're just keeping our eyes on what's going on. So stay in there, hang in there, and get the kids down to grandma's. They deserve it. They need it. And keep your eye on the ball.
Here's another question from Tom in Maine that I think many people are wondering. Chris, I'd like to get your thoughts on something I'm hearing conflicting information about. Deflation versus inflation, their causes, the potential range of time for each, and what to plan for in the short and long terms.
Ooh, yeah, this is on everybody's minds, and I think you framed it appropriately, Tom. That's why we're taking two questions from you. Good questions. The important point is around the conflicting information. There's all kinds of different definitions floating around, and so I think it's important to frame, what do we really mean by inflation or deflation? So we have all these textbooks examples out there which talk about, you know, which I absolutely believe in, that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. But I think there's a working definition that's really getting at the heart of what we need to think about today. We're going to define this term in a way that I think has some meaning for people, and that is, let's call inflation or deflation the value of your money going up or down relative to the things you need or want. So I know that can look like a symptom, but it's really important to talk about, because we're thinking about our responses and what we can do. And here's why this topic gets so confusing. Many times people say, are we going to have inflation or deflation? And my answer, and it's not flip, is yes. And the reason for that is that one person can be experiencing inflation as their primary component, while another person can be experiencing deflation. So let's imagine for the moment, right now today, you're a retired person and you have very significant expenses for prescription medications. Those are still going up in price. You are experiencing very real, very persistent inflation for the things you need. But if you happen to be living in Las Vegas and you're looking to buy a house and you have a lot of money saved up for buying a house, you're experiencing very pronounced deflation at this point in time. So it's entirely possible to experience both at once. And we are experiencing both of those right now. Now, here's another definition I want to get out. The first is around inflation itself. Inflation is primarily a local event, by which I mean it happens inside of a country. Hyperinflation happens across borders. I can't think of how hyperinflation can really be measured unless it's happening across a border in some way, shape, or form. So the real question for me in here is, what is the possibility of experiencing that hyperinflationary event? Because that's the real destroyer of countries, of social fabric, of wealth, of all kinds of things. And that's the primary thing that I'm focusing on. My current analysis says that we're going to be in what people are going to experience generally as a deflationary event for a while longer. Personally, I'm thinking this is going to go on for another 6 to 8 months at a minimum. And in that period of time, we're going to see further erosion of things, the destruction of debt, and, you know, companies closing and all kinds of things that happen with that. But sooner or later, all of this printed money is going to hit the economy again, and not in a good way. So we're going to experience the first upturn as a yay moment. There's yay, we're back and everything looks good. But I think it's going to morph rather rapidly into an inflationary and then potentially a hyperinflationary event. But how does that happen if it's happening worldwide? How do you have a real hyperinflationary event if there's no cross-border place for people to go and escape with their funds? If there's no way to measure your relative devaluation of one currency to another without a border in place that has some sort of differential across it. Now, that's the interesting part. So when I look at it, I'm thinking of it this way. Right now in America, there are 400,000 families with net worths of over $10 million. And if, for sake of example, let's imagine for the moment that you happen to be the fund advisor for the American branch of the Rothschild family, and all of a sudden the scion of the family says, we would like to put $1 billion of our dollars out of paper markets into things, other things, productive assets. We don't want paper anymore. We don't want stock certificates. We don't want bonds. We want stuff. Well, what would you do? And I think that, you know, that's to me what this next inflationary event is going to feel like. It's going to feel like people coming to the conclusion that they don't want to hold paper or paper representations, that the interest rates aren't compelling, they can't find a compelling story in the companies themselves, because companies get ravaged just like people do in an inflationary event, especially hyperinflationary events, and there'll be this massive flood out of paper money and representations of it into things. And when that happens, I think that there's a huge amount of concentrated wealth in this country that's just going to flood out and go into things. So think of anything you can imagine that you could buy in large enough size to hide or protect money for very large wealthy families. And you could start to get an idea of where I think we're going to start to experience the first bits of inflation and hyperinflation. Now, there's a very important component wrapped in that. The reason inflation happens is because people are holding money. I have $10 million as one of these 400,000 wealthy families. I'm holding on to it. It's kind of, you know, it's over here. It's stuck in a bank account. It's stuck in some bonds. It's stuck in some stocks. All of a sudden, I decide to liberate that money and make it go do something, and I'm going to go buy something from somebody. This brings up the concept of the velocity of money. So if we have all this money that's relatively stagnant, and all of a sudden the velocity of that money turns up because it's leaving the bank accounts, it's going out and finding things to buy, we're going to notice the first turn in this trend away from this sort of deflationary funk we're in right now into this hyperinflationary period. We're going to notice that in a change in the velocity of money. And that's just a fancy way of saying people are expressing a preference to not hold their money at that point in time. And that's what that's going to look like. So in terms of timing, I think I let you know, I think we've still got 6 to 8 months. I do believe that the hyperinflationary period that's probably almost inevitably going to follow from here would be out towards the end of the year. And I'm keeping my eye out for how that's going to happen or when that's going to happen first in watching the value of the currencies and currency pairs, the U.S. dollar at the top of my list. I'm watching interest rates and I'm watching the velocity of money, which is a hard thing to watch because it's reported on very slowly, and it's not something you can directly measure. It's an inferred statistic. So it's a little late, it's a little slow, but it's something to keep your eye on as well.
Okay, here's another tough question from Kate in Prairie Farm, Wisconsin. She asks, as both a Martinson Brigade member and an active transition town proponent, my main concern is this. As the financial crisis deepens and people lose their homes, is there a way over the shorter term to preserve the members of the very communities that we are trying to organize? I live in a rural area, and the last thing we need is to lose more farmers to bankruptcies.
Oh, Kate, you know, this is going to be a tough year for farmers in particular. I don't know about in your neck of the woods, but in general, as we look across the farming landscape, the collapse in commodity prices has arrived at precisely the same time as the highest ever recorded levels of farm debt. So what we're going to see is, obviously, that's a bad confluence of events. We're going to see a lot of farm bankruptcies ongoing this year. And that's going to take the form of both defaulting on the notes that cover their farms or the equipment or both. And so, you know, I'm watching the level of foreclosure activity that we're seeing and the level of bankruptcies that we're seeing are large enough that we have no historical precedence for them, really. It's just a staggering amount. And so in one sense, I'm wondering if this crisis isn't so large that there are literally too many places to foreclose on. And so I'm wondering if there isn't going to be some kind of a moratorium or just some admission that we're not going to be able to really foreclose on everybody. And I don't know how that would apply to your community. My advice here is that is anything that can be done to defer or delay the process of foreclosure, and anything that the community can do to organize around helping people remain in place for as long as possible would be great things for communities to organize around. And it's important to remember, foreclosure is a process. It's a legal process. And there are all kinds of very legal ways of deferring, delaying, avoiding the whole process. One thing is to convince the sheriff not to play along, either not to serve the forms or to be a real stickler that everything is 100% utterly legally correct before he's willing to go forward or she's willing to go forward and do that, and to take as much time as possible. A number of sheriffs have already done this. One out in Ohio famously has done this and said that he, in his estimation, because of how banks have behaved, he's not going to serve those papers. And so the whole process requires that sheriff to serve the papers. So, stopped. The foreclosure process is stopped there for a while until that gets resolved. Same advice could go for the local judges. If they're people, they live in the communities, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with taking them aside and asking them if it doesn't make sense in our community that we make sure that every single one of the absolute rules is followed to within an inch of its legal ability, so that we can take the time to evaluate and figure out what to do next. Now, growing numbers of people, including somebody I know here locally in my area, have started demanding that the deeds and the original mortgage documents are 100% there and that they're in order. And by in order, I mean one of the local guys around here, he just won a court case where he forced the mortgage company to try and find the original signed mortgage document, because we have a law here in Massachusetts that in order for the proceedings to be 100% legal, the original signed mortgage document has to be admitted into the evidentiary train. They had a Xeroxed copy, and he said, no good. So turned out they couldn't come up with the original signed document. Don't know where it is, but that's required. So that was a maneuver that he took, but in some ways it feels like bending the rules, but in some ways not. It's not. It's absolutely saying there are rules in place that were part of my frame of understanding at the time I signed the mortgage document, and I'm just here to assure that these are followed absolutely as correctly as possible. Now, you can read about this. Other people are using the same tactic. It's been all over the news recently as well. And they're having a tremendous amount of success with it, because in this huge mortgage heyday frenzy that went on, it turns out not a lot of these steps were actually followed as correctly as they were supposed to be followed. In the case of Massachusetts, where a legal required original signed mortgage document is part of the process, that's tricky for companies that actually filled out all the mortgage documentation online. They have an evidentiary train that's a little bit, it's going to take some legal resolution. So I guess my advice here sums down to learn the ropes, that there is some advantage to be gained for helping people really understand what their options are. And it's not, their options are often a lot wider and less constricting than you're in trouble, you didn't pay your mortgage, and that's just the end of that. There are many other ways to look at this. So I think it would be an incredible good thing to do for somebody to become a local mortgage expert and start providing legal guidance to people who need it.
All right, that's our last question for today, everybody. Chris, I appreciate that. The attention to detail can really serve us as we move forward, like those farmers in Wisconsin, perhaps. And I hope that reader can take your information and go help the farmers.
Well, thank you. Well, we've come to the end of another podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. As always, our purpose is to help you see around the corners ahead. Remember, the next 20 years are going to be completely unlike the last 20 years. None of us are going to get through these next few years alone. All of us are going to get through them together. I invite you to trust yourself in every decision and to assume responsibility for yourself, your community, and your future. Until next time, this is Chris Martinson.
And this is Becca.
Thank you for listening.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insights into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Bartenson next time to continue your journey towards awareness, understanding, and action.